Good afternoon, and welcome to Spokane Public Radio's Northwest Arts Review, a half hour exploring the people, places, and events forming the rich arts tapestry we enjoy here in the Inland Northwest and our wider Intermountain Northwest region. I'm Jim Tevenin, pleased to be your guide on this journey. This week, we welcome back Spokane Arts Executive Director Melissa Huggins for an update on the health of the visual arts community and preview the third event in the innovative Spokane Art on the Go phenomenon with its primary organizer, Morgan Walters. Dan Webster fills us in on a new semi-documentary film and we'll enjoy a poem from a beloved voice here at Spokane Public Radio, Mike Aleman. Music is courtesy of the Pan Pacific Wind Ensemble from their KPBX visit last January. It seems so long ago. This is Northwest Arts Review. Spokane Arts Executive Director Melissa Huggins was the Northwest Arts Review guest last March, just as the seriousness of the COVID pandemic was becoming evident and arts-related events began to disappear from the landscape. We recently caught up again with Melissa and got an update on the state of the arts hereabouts. Share with us, if you could, some of the things that you think went well for Spokane Arts in the period through now, and maybe even some of the things that were frustrating that you wish you could have done but weren't able to.
It has been a wild 6 months, about 6 months now. Mm-hmm. So a couple of the things that we sort of jumped into action on were creating some relief funds, which I think we had talked about a little bit before.
Yes.
Spokane Arts had created an emergency relief fund for individual artists so that people would have some funding to be able to pay their rent and buy health insurance and cover some basic necessities after all of these events were canceled with so little notice and everyone immediately lost work. And so that was a big part of the pandemic for us. And we feel really good about the degree to which we were able to do that. And the community really rallied behind that effort. Artists who were in a position to donate really supported that. Christy Branson and Daniel Lopez and many other artists donated to that effort and supported that effort to help their fellow artists, and lots of community members rallied behind that. And so we were able to do a good amount of grant making through that, and we were also able to make some emergency adjustments to our regular grant making, which is the SAGA program, the mm-hmm. Spokane Arts Grant Awards. And we shifted some money that we had allocated for next year's grant awards and moved it into this year so that we were able to give away more funding this year when it was so desperately needed. So the round two of grant making kind of fell during the real middle of the pandemic this year. So we had a number of grantees who just burst into tears when they got the news that they had been awarded a grant from SAGA, because, as you know, the need is so great and any kind of glimmer of hope is, you know, we're all wanting to celebrate those positive outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And how about some things that you wish you could have done or done more of or more with during this period?
I think a big part of how we, or at least I, on behalf of Spokane Arts, have been spending my time is on advocacy. You know, that's been talking to our state representatives and talking to our federal representatives. And I think there's a lot of disappointment that there hasn't been relief from the federal level. You know, we're all kind of waiting for Congress to meet and to come up with what they're going to do next. So I think that that is a disappointment that we weren't able to push our congressional representatives into some action before the summer break, because as everyone knows, as has been widely reported on, you know, people's unemployment benefits are running out, but their work has not returned. You know, all of the performing arts venues are still closed. They aren't able to employ their, you know, musicians and actors and performers and comedians. And so as a result, there are many, many people who simply aren't able to do the work that they have studied and trained to do. That's becoming a real emergency situation. Part of the challenge that we're facing is that, well, a couple of things. The state, of course, is facing a massive budget hole, somewhere between $8 and $10 billion, the last that I heard. And I think that the state is waiting for Congress to act before they can figure out how they should respond. You know, they're waiting for Congress to figure out what they're going to do, and then the state can respond accordingly and make their plan. So everyone is kind of holding their breath, waiting for Congress to do something, anything.
Right. What are your hopes for what you will be able to do with the art community this fall? I know that there is coming up in a couple of weeks the latest announcement of the Saga grants. But beyond that, what are your hopes for what's coming next?
Speaking broadly, so many arts organizations and cultural institutions in Spokane are and have been throughout the pandemic just doing such an incredible job of pivoting. And, you know, everyone has had to come up with, I don't know, at this point, 350 different plans for what they might do and how they can keep their audience engaged and try to put some performers to work. So I think there's some really interesting things that are happening. Just to give one example, the Spokane Civic Theater has an open call right now for young people, for teens and young adults, to submit a short performance to Spokane Civic Theater. They can pick anything they want, and that will be edited into, you know, kind of a lovely live stream broadcast to highlight all of the local acting talent. And each of the young people who participates in that process will get some individualized feedback and kind of workshop and advice from folks at the Civic, including the director of the Civic Theater and some other experts in the performing arts community. And so that's just one example of the ways that people are getting really creative with how do we still provide art, how do we keep people engaged, how do we, you know, remind our audience that we are real people who are here and serve the community. I think so many of our local arts organizations are just so passionate about serving the community. And so I think when we're pleading for help from our federal representatives, it's not just about saving jobs, it's about the service that these nonprofits provide to the community. I think it'll be interesting to see the ways in which people try to work to provide online programming, virtual programming. I'm also hopeful the city of Spokane did allocate, the mayor and city council allocated some funding specifically in response to the pandemic. They received some federal CARES Act dollars, and a portion of that was dedicated to the arts. We made a number of presentations to council and the mayor's office to kind of articulate the need, and they understood the economic impact that these organizations and venues have. So there will be some additional grant funding that is coming forward, both for individual artists and for small to mid-sized organizations, especially performing arts venues. So that's a glimmer of hope for this fall as well.
Artists, especially musicians, have had to adapt to COVID realities, often in highly creative and innovative ways. But as Melissa Huggins points out, there remains a void that only live performance can fill.
Particularly for musicians, I think, are such a great example because, you know, many musicians and bands were able, they had, you know, the technical capability or they had the understanding and ability to be able to say, okay, we're going to do some live shows. And, you know, some people chose to stream those for free and encourage people to donate. You know, sometimes there's an online tip jar that people can set up to have virtual concerts. And you know, some folks have enough of a built-in audience that they can, you know, charge a small ticket price for those. But I think that what we found and what we heard from a lot of musicians was that this many months into the pandemic, we're all very much longing for the real thing. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone is working. So many people are working on their screens, and their kids are going to school on their screens, and we're also, you know, taking in entertainment via our screens. And there's just a lot of screen fatigue, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, many musicians were sort of like, this isn't worth it. We need the real thing. We want the real thing. We want to be able to work. We just don't have the venues to be able to work right now.
Right. That's a genuine need, I think, because everything else aside, no matter how good the sound system that is hooked up to your screen is, there's a problem of bandwidth, and the sound is never going to be even close to what you get when you're there in the room, in the hall, with the music
exactly.
playing live.
And the emotional experience of, mm-hmm. you know, all of the scientific data that shows that when people are in a hall or in a theater listening to music, you know, their heartbeats sync up. We're all having an emotional and physical experience listening to live music. And that, unfortunately, you know, that can't translate through the screen. So we're all doing the best we can, I think. But you know, that's just to note how many you know, performing artists and artists of all types, as you said, visual artists and writers and all kinds of artists who are just so eager to get back to work. And the pandemic has really taken away most of their outlets for doing that work.
Mm-hmm. Well, Melissa Huggins, you present to us reason for hope and reason still for frustration in this whole situation. It has been a real kind of revelation of the human spirit at work as we really try to keep these various flames flickering at least until they can burst forth again. So thank you. Thank you so much for what Spokane Arts does, and we look forward to let's hope for a more bright and hopeful time the next time we get together.
Yes, absolutely. I agree.
Our guest was Melissa Huggins, Executive Director of Spokane Arts. Find out more about the organization and its programs at SpokaneArts.org. We've reported on the first two Art on the Go events in the last 6 months. Now there's a third, happening this weekend, with its focal point right across the street from our Spokane Public Radio Firehouse studios at Spokane Art Supply. As it turns out, not the originally planned venue. I talked with main organizer Morgan Walters. Let's go back to the very beginning, because your concept here was actually geographically a little bit different. You were aiming for the West Plains, weren't you?
When the original idea came about, it was supposed to be a West Plains art show. However, due to certain regulations, we were unable to facilitate that at this time. And thankfully, we had the option to move into Spokane and at the Art Supply parking lot. So we've had to do kind of a roundabout twist and turn, if you will. We had to revamp the whole idea, but it really turned out in the end, because now a lot more people can participate compared to where we were originally supposed to set up for this.
For those who are unfamiliar with the concept, and a very successful concept it is now, when was the first Art on the Go event?
Earlier this year, we had planned on doing a drive-by event where artists would just put their arts in their windows, mm-hmm. but now with the whole COVID thing, it's completely changed and evolved into a life of its own. The second Art on the Go event took place in June, on June 6th, and we had a lot of fun with that. We had 104 participants. Our first show, we had 64 that we'd planned in 10 days, and then the second event, we had a month to plan, and we had 104. So it's grown each time, and today everything has kind of changed, and we're back to that 10-day deadline. But we know that we've done it before, and we can do it again. So spur of the moment, we had planned on possibly doing something in October, but due with the weather and how we weren't sure what that was going to do, we wanted to make sure we could get in at least one more event by the end of the year.
Morgan and I talked about the ongoing popularity of art on the go with artists and public alike.
Yes, we've actually received messages on and off throughout the few months asking when there would be another event. And originally we had decided that it was possibly going to be just an annual event, maybe once a year. But the popularity and messages that we've received, we just have to do more. And the more things that have been canceled and the more artists that are struggling right now, and not just artists, people in general that are looking for something positive and uplifting and memorable to do, that's the goal here. And it's just fun to see everybody smiles when they drive by and just know that you're making that positive impact in the community. You don't know what kid might see that and want to become an artist or might try something new or what it might inspire.
Here's the basic information about the latest Art on the Go.
The date is Saturday, September 19th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. People will have the option to go online. We have the overflow of artists that couldn't fit into that parking lot space. So we'll be doing similar with like a combo with the Art on the Go for those overflow of artists. We'll have those addresses and it will all end at the market. What we want to accomplish is connect people with the arts, with the artists, possibly inspire something new, maybe make a few sales. We'll see what happens. But really, it's just getting people out there and enjoying the day and enjoying everybody.
And finally, Morgan had a word of gratitude for those who make Art on the Go happen.
I really have to give a huge thanks out to our team because we could not do this without you and to the artists. You guys make it all possible. Without this collaboration, this would not be possible. So thank you to everyone involved for making this day great and others and future events.
For more on Art on the Go, go to their Facebook page. Time for a musical interlude, courtesy of the Pullman-based Pan Pacific Ensemble, who visited KPBX way back in January. From that visit, here's a bit of the piece Iron Horses by Nick Omaccioli. Thank you. Writer and retired teacher Mike Aylman is a frequent and welcome guest here at Spokane Public Radio. A couple of weeks ago, he was featured on our Poetry Moment, that program heard on KPBX and now on Montana Public Radio as well. He closed his week's tenure with a COVID-inspired poem of his own, Fever Territory.
Tomorrow it is going to be 102 degrees. And since we are comfortable at 98.6, we're headed into serious fever territory. I can hear my mother's reminders to drink plenty of water and wear that hat, as if she was sure I couldn't think of it myself. But then she had never played right field. As a boy, when I had a fever, my Mexican grandmother, who lived by a marriage of faith and superstition, slid a raw egg in a dish under my bed while I was asleep so I wouldn't burn up in the night. And when morning had broken, so had the fever. Dried or fried, my fever was gone. To my mother's great distraction, mi abuela also turned mirrors to the wall when her grandchildren were sick. For she knew if we looked into the mirror, our strength would leave us and enter the mirrored image. Afterwards, rosary in hand, she knelt in front of her vanity, on top of which burned 7 red candles, and prayed for our healing. Laugh at my grandmother if you will, be it superstition, religion, or damned foolishness. For 77 years, I've passed through the Valley of the Shadow on numerous journeys into fever territory, and am still here to tell the story. That was Fever Territory by me, Mike Aylman. Thank you for listening to the Poetry Moment.
And finally, here's Dan Webster's take on documentary filmmaker Barbara Koppel's Desert One.
The passage of history is a slow, sometimes maddeningly gradual process, the larger effects of which often become comprehensible only years afterward when scholars attempt to put them in some sort of perspective. And as America's current political and social polarization shows, any sort of common perspective is becoming appreciably more difficult to achieve, which is why we need more filmmakers such as Barbara Koppel. The winner of 2 Oscars for Best Documentary Feature, first for 1976's Harlan County, USA, and the second for 1990's American Dream, Koppel is an old-school type of documentarian who strives to present stories that stick to the facts and then let said facts speak for themselves. That's not to say that she doesn't present a point of view. Her sympathies in Harlan County, USA, are firmly on the side of the miners who were striking for better working conditions and pay. In American Dream, though, she shows what can happen when labor, in this case the union representing workers at a Minnesota packing plant, overestimates its power. Koppel's adherence to traditional documentary style, blended with a bit of contemporary stylisms, are on full display in her latest feature titled Desert One, which was produced originally for the History Channel and which I streamed at home through the Seattle International Film Festival's virtual cinema. Desert One takes its name from a failed attempt by a joint U.S. military force to rescue the 52 Americans who had been taken hostage 5 months earlier on November 4, 1979, in the first wave of the Iranian Revolution. That name was what Mission Control called a landing spot in a remote part of Iran used by Air Force cargo planes and Navy helicopters taking off respectively from the nation of Oman and the aircraft carrier USS Nimitz as the staging spot for the final push into the Tehran embassy where the hostages were being housed. The detailed plan, which one of the movie's commentators describes charitably as having too many working parts, almost immediately began to break down. Some of the helicopters developed problems and had to turn back. Afterward, a bus full of Iranian civilians happened upon the supposedly deserted road next to where the Americans had landed. Then, after the mission had already been scrubbed, a dust storm caused by helicopter rotors blinded a pilot who then crashed his helicopter into one of the cargo planes, causing a huge fire and the deaths of 8 crewmen. The details of the crash itself comprise one of Koppel's concessions to contemporary documentary filmmaking as she uses animated sequences to recreate what happened. Koppel's overall film, though, is much more than a mere look at that single mission, which was officially dubbed as Operation Eagle Claw. While interviewing a whole range of officials these 4 decades after the fact, from then President Jimmy Carter on down to such captives as Marine Guard Kevin J. Hermenning, along with several mission operatives and intelligence consultants, Koppel outlines why and how the Iranian Revolution occurred in the first place. As is now clear, the roots extended back to the 1953 U.S. Baku coup that ousted Iran's democratically elected Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh and replaced him with the Western-friendly Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The simmering resentment against the Shah's harsh governing style built over the decades until, supported by the cleric Ayatollah Khomeini, citizens revolted, stormed the U.S. embassy, and imprisoned the workers. Meanwhile, the Shah fled, traveling from country to country before dying in Egypt on July 27, 1980. Koppel also documents how the whole hostage situation affected the U.S. itself, from Carter's insistence on trying to solve the problem through diplomacy to the protests by Iranian supporters against the Shah. Criticism was thrown at Carter in particular from civilians such as Marine Hermening's mother, Barbara Tim, whose visit to her captive son aroused much controversy. And notably, presidential candidate Ronald Reagan would ride his own censure of Carter to victory the following November. Finally, though, Koppel's movie acts as a memorial to the members of the mission itself, especially to those eight men who died doing what they saw as their duty. History may not look back kindly at some of Carter's decisions, especially to trust the military to pull off such an overly complicated plan. But the courage shown by the men who volunteered to implement that plan, however futile their sacrifice proved to be, deserves to be remembered and to be honored. Regardless of our personal politics, that's a duty of history we should all find easy to embrace. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Dan Webster.
Movies 101 host Dan Webster writes about movies and more for Spokane7.com. Thanks for listening to Northwest Arts Review. I'm Jim Tevenin. Our thanks today to Melissa Huggins, Morgan Walters, Mike Aylman, and Dan Webster. Also, the Pan Pacific Ensemble, whose playing takes us out. Join us again next week for another Northwest Arts Review.